Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are starting a new series discussing the Trump administration's authoritarian actions and policies, from masked ICE agents rounding people up and placing them in unmarked cars and sending the National Guard to Washington, D.C., to targeting colleges and freezing federal grant funding. Every week, we will summarize the latest news, put it in historical context, and find out how people are responding. So much has happened since Trump took office in January. Trump and his administration have fundamentally altered the role of government for decades to come. We don't hear much about Elon Musk anymore, but it's important to remember that Trump gave the world's richest man free rein to dismantle the federal workforce and smash the administrative state. So there's the marriage of government and corporate power, making money off of the presidency, firing people he doesn't like, attacking the free press, free speech, and academic freedom, creating a world where facts don't matter, using political violence as a tool to get his way, and othering those who are not white Christians. During his first administration, we would spend an hour on these individual issues. But this administration is just moving so fast. It is impossible to keep up and cover it all. So every week, we'll do our best to summarize the big news and highlight the news that gets buried. Joining us to kick off our first show are two guests. Ben Raderstorf is policy advocate at Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan anti-authoritarianism group. Ben Raderstorf helps direct policy and communications work around systemic threats to U.S. democracy. He also writes If You Can Keep It, a Substack newsletter about Trump's latest actions. Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's such a treat to be on with you.
Great to have you. Kurt Vilund is professor in liberal arts at the University of Texas in Austin. His several books include Assault on Democracy, Communism, Fascism, and Authoritarianism During the Interwar Years, and Democracy's Resilience to Populism's Threat, Countering Global Alarmism. Hi, Professor Vilund. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Happy to discuss these issues with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Professor Vilund, I was reading an op-ed in the Washington Post that you wrote right after the election with Eva Belin, professor of Arab politics at Brandeis. And you both wrote, there are indeed choppy waters ahead for American democracy, but we're confident that the United States is a strong ship that even an unhinged captain cannot run aground. Its infrastructure makes possible for mobilization of speech, protest, litigation, and countervailing power, all of which can limit the de-democratizing ambitions of any president. It falls to us to make use of those tools. So I'm wondering, Professor Vilund, 9 months later, where do you stand? How are you feeling today?
So I have to admit, I'm feeling significantly worse because I had not anticipated the aggressive and transgressive attack that Donald Trump would unleash. This is worse than I had anticipated. I had thought, you know, there would be a good amount of pressure on liberal democracy, on freedom of speech. There would, of course, be his policy initiatives about deportation of people, attack on the federal government, those kinds of things. But that it would be with such intensity, with such energy, with such transgressiveness, I had not anticipated that. And what I also hadn't anticipated is that the reaction is weaker and meeker than I had thought. First of all, the Republicans in Congress are just going along with, not only in Congress, here in the state of Texas, are just going along with whatever Donald Trump wants. And so you have a whole bunch of people whose conservative convictions should make them averse to the arbitrary populist initiatives that Donald Trump takes, but they just keel over and go along because they're worried about primary challenges and those kinds of things. And then I had also thought there would be more of a response from civil society. And so things are significantly worse than I had anticipated. I do believe, however, that in the end, American democracy will survive. I think the institutional framework is still quite strong. I think the courts have played an important role in reining in Donald Trump. And what is always hard to figure out, I mean, Trump, the president, has the prime mover advantage and the power of initiative, so he can do all kinds of things. And the courts, other groups of resistance trying to contain this takes a longer time, is less visible, harder to figure out. But I think that is happening, and I think that will prevent the worst. And I think American democracy will survive this severe stress test. I think this is a more severe stress test. There's already been a good amount of what people call democratic backsliding, but I think the system will survive, democracy will survive. There will not be what people have feared, what some people have already pronounced already in February, that the United States had sunk into authoritarian rule. I think that is premature. I think that is exaggerated. I think there is a very good chance that Donald Trump will not get away with his aggressive, transgressive push, that sooner or later other forces will mobilize, for example, in the midterm elections next year, and this that this can and will be stopped. And so while I am more concerned than I was when I wrote that op-ed, I think the bottom line that American democracy will survive, I still think that that is the most likely outcome because of specific features of American democracy and society, and also the, you know, political science for decades has argued that rich countries do not sink into authoritarian rule. Political science for decades has argued that democracies with strong consolidated institutions do not collapse. So not only I would be wrong based on that book and that op-ed, but 90% of political science would be wrong. And so, you know, I hope that in the end we will be proven right and that American democracy will survive this stress test.
Professor Weiland, are you hearing similar sentiments from your colleagues that this was worse than they anticipated?
What I hear is, I hear way more alarmism. I am among the less alarmist people among in my profession. I mean, a number of scholars have already declared the United States as an authoritarian regime or sinking into authoritarianism. And you can see that very prominently Steve Levitsky, who wrote this excellent book, How Democracies Die, 7 years ago, he wrote in the New York Times and in Foreign Affairs that the United States was sinking or had already descended into authoritarian rule. There is a group of, it's called Brightline Watch, a group of leading scholars are polling political scientists regularly, and there is a lot of concern and a lot of people. A lot of political scientists think the situation is much worse than my assessment is. And they think that, you know, Trump will get away with way more than I would expect, that the situation is way more dire, that the backsliding and the move to authoritarian rule is way more advanced than I would think. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned my book, the subtitle is Countering Global Alarmism. So I'm still among the less alarmist people in my field.
That is Kurt Weiland, professor in liberal arts at the University of Texas in Austin. We're also joined today by Ben Raderstorf, policy advocate at Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan anti-authoritarianism group. What is your read on all of this so far, Ben? In one of your recent Substack pieces, you write that Donald Trump and the MAGA movement broke the bipartisan consensus, and now his administration is actively seeking to destroy the political administrative divide in all areas of American government.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a three-part answer. I agree with a lot of what Professor Weiland said. I think it is true that things have gone considerably worse than I expected at the outset of this administration, not because personally I wasn't surprised by the speed and swift of the attacks that the administration has leveled against many of our core institutions. What has surprised me has been the relative weakness of the collective response, especially from powerful elite institutions, universities, business leaders, even the media. I think has been much more susceptible to the sort of divide and conquer strategies that the Trump administration has used, singling out single targets, you know, whether it's Paramount, CBS News, or Harvard University. You know, when they've gone after a single target, Instead of the rest of civil society coming together to try to defend those attacks, there has been an instinct to run and hide and keep your head down. We're seeing this in all sorts of sectors, and that sort of anticipatory obedience, you know, what historian Tim Snyder calls obeying in advance, has happened to a much greater degree than I anticipated, and that is really scary. Fundamentally, I think that is the biggest threat to our democracy right now, is not just the attacks, but the relatively weak reaction to them. At the same time, the second part, the silver lining, is we are still very early in this process. What the Trump administration is attempting to build is what political scientists would call a competitive authoritarian regime, which means that for this to work, they have to remain popular. And I think there's some evidence that that is not working, right? So the ability to really consolidate power in the long term and extinguish the competitive aspects of democracy, the ability of the voters to throw out their leaders, right? That takes them consolidating a degree of political power that I don't know if we are seeing. But then the third part, the dark lining to that silver lining, is I think even if they fail to consolidate power in a way that allows them to rule for years and decades, even if they don't reach that point, the sort of institutional damage that we are seeing is really profound. And that gets to the piece you raised on sort of the corruption of independent apolitical institutions, whether it's the Federal Reserve or the civil service. Those sort of attacks are going to be permanent, and it's going to be very difficult to rebuild those things now that they are damaged.
And to your point about maintaining power, we'll talk in a bit about what Trump has said about ending mail-in voting. We'll talk about what is happening with redistricting, because this is all very connected to the Republican Party maintaining power. You brought up media, and Ben, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how legacy media are covering this. And I think because things move so fast, I just want to remind everyone, we did a show on July 29th about Paramount, the owner of CBS, Disney, the owner of ABC, agreeing to pay Trump millions of dollars to settle lawsuits. The White House has banned Associated Press reporters from the Oval Office and other presidential events after the AP refused to change the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. The White House prohibited a Wall Street Journal reporter from boarding Air Force One to cover Trump's trip to Scotland, after the paper published an article on July 17th called Jeffrey Epstein's Friends Sent Him Body Letters for a 50th Birthday. One was from Trump. And then he's filed a $10 billion defamation suit against News Corp and Chair Emeritus and longtime Trump ally Rupert Murdoch. News Corp owns the Wall Street Journal. I mean, this alone would have been headline news for days, but we just move on to the next major event. So it's hard to remember all these things. So I wonder, Ben, what are your thoughts on how the media are covering this? I know it's a big question, but we have been just struggling because so much is happening so quickly. And, you know, even under his first term, we would have spent an hour on the ICE raids, an hour on the National Guard in D.C., but we just don't have the time for it. And so that's why we decided to start this new weekly series where we summarize things, put it in context, and then talk about how people are or are not responding.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right response. I mean, the challenge of the sort of attacks, of threats that we're seeing coming from the White House, it is that they are so overwhelming. That is by design. They want to flood the zone, is the deliberate strategy that they're using. And it puts our media infrastructure and ecosystem in a difficult place because it is used to covering things story by story, event by event. And in my view, the American media just is not used to having to cover the sort of big picture storylines and trends of an autocrat in the White House. There are those who are adapting and are doing a really excellent job, independent stations like yours, many publications like The Atlantic or The Bulwark or others have really risen to the moment. But I do think that especially in some of the more legacy institutions, the zooming back from the day-to-day fire hose, it's really challenging, and spaces like this are critical for it.
Professor Vilund, what are your thoughts on legacy media's overall coverage of what's happening? And do you think they're connecting the dots?
So I read mainly the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I think they're doing a pretty good job uncovering this and also not getting distracted by all the multitude of events that are assailing us every day, but, you know, trying to put things together. I mean, I read articles there that try to provide bigger picture analysis, what is happening in the Senate right now, what is happening in different institutions. So my sense is this is pretty good, and I don't see any very serious like intimidation or backing off or soft pedaling, you know. So Donald Trump has tried to do that with, for example, the lawsuits that you mentioned or these arbitrary exclusions of journalists. But I don't think that has had a ton of impact, fortunately. I mean, Donald Trump is a master of commanding attention and a master of theatrics. That's the typical populist style. You do these kind of ostentatious coups and, you know, that's what he does, but I don't think there has been a very serious restriction on, for example, press freedom and the coverage of events. And my sense is that the legacy media are doing quite a good job in, you know, providing an overview picture, not just zeroing in on every daily event.
Well, on today's Your Call, we are starting a new series discussing the Trump administration's authoritarian actions and policies. Just like you, we're having a hard time keeping up. So every week, we'll do our best to summarize the latest news, put it in historical context, and find out how people are or are not responding. Today, we're joined by Kurt Weiland, professor in liberal arts at the University of Texas in Austin. He's the author of many books, including Assault on Democracy, Communism, Fascism, and Authoritarianism During the Interwar Years, and Democracy's Resilience to Populism's Threat, Countering Global Alarmism. We're also joined by Ben Raderstorf, policy advocate at Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan anti-authoritarianism group. He also writes If You Can Keep It, a Substack newsletter about Trump's latest actions. If you'd like to join our conversation, how are you keeping up with the news? Is there something that has happened over the months, last few months, that you feel deserves more attention? And what are your thoughts about putting all of this in historical context? Do you think people are responding? Do you see people responding in your communities? There were about 300 protests over the weekend. So there's a lot going on that doesn't always get media attention, and we're also going to follow that. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What concerns you the most? You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from a listener who says, it's great to be optimistic about this disaster unfolding in front of us, but why be naive? Can your guest please articulate why he's optimistic despite the obliteration of all norms? He hasn't said exactly why or how we come out of this, with the legislative and judicial branches totally capitulating to the executive. So can you elaborate, Professor Weiland, about why you think democracy will survive?
So, as I mentioned, the Republicans in Congress have been extremely meek and extremely cowardly. But, you know, when people talk about the legislative branch, I have hopes in the midterm elections next year that despite the gerrymandering, the Democrats should have a very good chance of winning the House of Representatives. You mentioned Trump's low popularity. I hear that the tariffs and other measures, including the deportations, are raising price levels. And so, you know, the broader trends are moving in that direction. And then what I don't agree with is the claim that the courts are just capitulating to Donald Trump. I mean, there have been a lot of court decisions that have reined in what Donald Trump can do. In most cases, Donald Trump has actually complied with these court orders, and those are important constraints and important restrictions. A lot of cases are still winding through the judiciary, so we don't know what the final outcome will be, and people are concerned about the Supreme Court because Donald Trump in his first term managed to appoint three of the judges. But I think that when it comes to really democracy violating arbitrariness, these people who are conservatives, not populists, will also continue to rein him in maintaining the basic democratic institutions, the basic outlines of the rule of law in this country. So I don't agree that the courts have just capitulated. I also think that while society so far has been meeker in its response than I had expected, and while the protests that have happened haven't had the magnitude to do a lot of, put a lot of constraint on Donald Trump, I think there is sufficient mobilizational energy, sufficient resources in American society. The United States has a strong opposition party, which many countries where a populist leader managed to push the country into authoritarian rule did not have. So all of that gives me a good deal of hope that in the run-up to the midterm elections, and then, of course, in the run-up to the next presidential elections, there will be a lot of counter-mobilization. You know, hopefully there will be another blue wave as it hit the Republican Party in 2018. And so I think those are some of the main reasons why I think democracy will survive. There's one very basic fundamental point that I think in the United States is often taken for granted, which is the following. In my book, I look at 40 countries where populist chief executives have taken office, and I find that only in 7 of those cases, these populist leaders have actually strangled, destroyed democracy. And in 5 of those 7 cases, they did it through an early, dramatic, profound overhaul of the Constitution so that they could concentrate power, dismantle checks and balances. In the United States, that's just out of the question. I mean, the United States has such a rigid, firm constitution that is as an ultimate safeguard, in my view. And so there's a whole bunch of arguments. Federalism is an important constraint, a whole bunch of institutional features, the strength of civil society, the strength of the Democratic Party. That's what I base my hope on. So.
And I want to jump in here, too. I think my view is I don't think anyone knows if American democracy will survive. Nobody knows for sure. It is a choice that we collectively as Americans get to make in how we respond to this. But the one thing that we do know is that a core part of authoritarian strategy in every context, not just here in the US, is despair. They want their opponents, their opposition, and society writ large to feel like it is a fiat accompli, right? Like they want it to feel like it is hopeless. So if you feel that sense of fear and despair, an overwhelming sense of powerlessness, that is what Donald Trump wants you to feel. That does not necessarily mean it is true. And collectively, as Americans, we very much have the power to ensure that our democracy survives. If we believe that it can, that's a key part of making sure that it does.
Well, thank you for that email. And if you missed our show yesterday, we spoke with Democracy Forward CEO Skye Perryman, and they have filed more than 100 legal actions against the Trump administration. They've had a lot of successes. They're working to protect access to reproductive care in Texas, fair representation in Alabama, the freedom to read in Arkansas. They're trying to stop the administration from defunding the Violence Against Women Act. Again, so much there. But if you head over to Democracy Forward's website, democracyforward.org, you can read more about the lawsuits that they're filing. Thanks for that email. Let's hear from a caller before we go to break. Let's go to Parker in San Francisco. Hi, Parker. Thanks for holding.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate your panels for all the work they've done and for what they're talking about today. I just wanted to bring up, you know, you're talking about the, like, meek civic response. And I kind of wanted to bring up, like, some broader, I guess, economic context, too. I feel like every time I hear from people in this country, it's a lot of frustration, feeling like a lack of material resources from themselves, feeling like they're not making enough money to make ends meet, living paycheck to paycheck. We're getting Trump establishing tax cuts for the rich and not allowing us to have any additional money. And I think part of what I want to understand is, like, how do you talk to people when they feel so desperate and so, like, under-resourced about getting also fired up about this, like, civic response? You know, I feel like for a lot of people, when they get into that desperate place, they end up mostly just focusing on exclusively themselves and how they can get by, which then makes it hard for them to really care at all about, like, what's going on in our broader civic society if it isn't directly impacting them. So I guess I wanted to bring up that kind of economic context and think about like how we can still create like a strong civic response in spite of that.
This is such a good question. Thank you, Parker. And I would just add to that, if you're Black or brown, in many cases, you're also afraid because look what's happening on the streets. We're going to talk about this after a break, but we talked about it yesterday. Masked agents grabbing people off of the streets. Ben, what are your thoughts? How do you stay active given what Parker laid out? People are struggling to make ends meet and people are also afraid.
Yeah, I want to say at first, I feel this. I see this with people I know in my life. It's remarkably hard for everyone in every circumstance to look beyond their day-to-day concerns and think about the big picture issues. The thing that I try to do when I talk to people is I try to find ways to connect what's happening to things that personally impact them, right? And to ask questions, you know, what is it that they are concerned about? Because the thing that we know from around the world and research from political scientists like Professor Valent have found this, that autocracies are overwhelmingly more unequal and less prosperous than democracies. So these are, you know, these aren't just big institutional, you know, amorphous questions that don't really apply to people's material circumstances, right? The stakes here, I mean, we're already seeing it in some of the economic decisions and policy decisions that the Trump administration has forced through. The tariffs are overwhelmingly impact low-income people, way more so than higher-income people. The big reconciliation bill that largely financed, you know, tax relief for wealthy earners, on the backs of cutting social safety net programs. These are the sort of things that we expect to see in authoritarian contexts all around the world, not to mention the sort of the larger economic damage that things like a tax on the Federal Reserve can do to our economy as a whole, right? So finding ways to connect that, you know, this is not just a sort of kumbaya, you know, we all want to believe in democracy because it sounds nice, right? Like the stakes here are very real for real people's lives. And I think we're going to see that more and more as the damage spreads throughout our economy.
Professor Vineland, what are your thoughts?
So this is a very interesting question, and the various points that I would like to make. First, one of the amazing things is that a lot of supporters of Donald Trump are actually materially not well off, and they see themselves as losers of globalization, the losers of deindustrialization. They live in the areas where rural hospitals close, where the Medicaid cuts will hit the worst. And so one thing that is really kind of amazing is that a lot of people don't act in politics just based on their material circumstances and their pocketbook issues. I mean, these people keep voting for somebody who claims to be a billionaire and who provides a lot of benefits for his super rich friends. And so the connection between people's material circumstances and their political preferences and political choices is less direct than one would think. Where, however, I think people's material circumstances, so, and I think that is because you have party identification that plays an important role that can override people's assessment of their own material circumstances. You have Trump's charismatic appeal to many voters. Where, however, I think those material factors might come in, and I think they played a role, for example, in the 2024 election, is there still is a certain small percentage of Americans who are comparatively independent, who are not committed, and in a country that is as evenly polarized, that where the, you know, the Democratic and Republican side have pretty much about 50% of the vote. Those voters who seem to have decided a lot on pocketbook issues might actually play, if you wish, a disproportionate role in elections because they can swing the balance. So there, that plays an important role in elections. People who face material needs, face material deprivation, often don't have the time, energy, resources to go out and protest, to take other types of political participation. But voting, there I think it can play a role. And there it might actually, you know, if really these tariffs and other measures that the Trump administration is taking are making lives harder for common people, that might really come to haunt them, for example, in the midterm elections and then the next presidential elections. But the impact of material factors on politics is less direct and straightforward than one would think.
And just quickly, Professor Weiland, since you brought up voters, in 2024, there were about 173 million people registered to vote in the United States. But in this last presidential election, 90 million people did not vote. So more people did not vote than voted in this country. What does that tell you? I mean, we really don't know where the country stands, right? Because so many people don't vote.
Yes. I mean, you don't know where the country stands. And I mean, this country makes it comparatively difficult to vote. You have to register on your own. I mean, in Germany, I get a card from the election administration that does all the footwork for me. And so therefore, you see in many European countries, electoral participation is much higher than in the United States. And that is a complicated issue. It is very interesting because the political impact of that has shifted in recent years as a result of Donald Trump's populism, because it used to be that the Democratic Party had disproportionate support from less well-off and less educated people. So low electoral participation used to hurt the Democratic Party more. But with Donald Trump, there has been a real shift in the Republican Party such that now lower income and especially less educated segments of the population are disproportionately supporting the Republican Party. And so now abstention, non-voting, actually risks hurting the Republican Party more. And Donald Trump and his friends really have to go out and make a huge effort to mobilize these people. And so the point about limited electoral participation in this country is playing out in interesting ways that are less clearly damaging to the Democrats than it used to be in earlier elections. I mean, the Republican Party has really won support among segments that by nature are not the likely voters. And so the burden on mobilizing them is actually falling ever more on the Republican Party.
And we are putting a show together about why 6 million people who voted for Biden did not vote for Harris. There's a really interesting information out from Celinda Lake and Way to Win, and we're putting a show together on that. Today on Your Call, we are starting a new series discussing the Trump administration's authoritarian actions and policies. Every week, we'll do our best to summarize the latest news, put it in historical context, and find out how people are responding. Kurt Weiland is professor in liberal arts at the University of Texas in Austin. Ben Raderstorff is policy advocate at Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan anti-authoritarianism group. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will mark California Public Radio Day by opening the lines to find out what you want to hear on Your Call. We want to find out what's on your mind during these unprecedented times. As you know, the Republican Party recently voted to defund public radio, and so many of you have stepped up to support KALW and Your Call. And I'm sure if you're listening on another station, so many of you have stepped up to support that station, and we're so grateful. We can only do this with your support, and we just want to check in to find out how you're all doing, because I think that's also important during these times. Today, we are starting a new series discussing the Trump administration's authoritarian actions and policies. Like you, we just can't keep up. So every week, we'll summarize the latest news, put it in historical context, and find out how people are or are not responding. We're joined today by Ben Raderstorff, policy advocate at Protect Democracy. He writes the If You Can Keep It Substack newsletter. Kurt Weiland is professor in liberal arts at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of many books, including Democracy's Resilience to Populism's Threat, Countering Global Alarmism. Let's go to our next caller, Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for holding.
Thank you. My issue is with newspapers and the news media. They tend to report the story about what Trump does, but they don't always connect the dots to the disenfranchised people who wind up voting for Trump because they don't realize that the dots are connected and they're going to be harmed by everything that Trump is doing. I read the newspapers and I'm very disappointed that the dots aren't connected. People do not always realize when they're being harmed by Trump. And the newspapers think all they have to do is lay out the facts and somehow people will put it together. No, they have to put it together for the people. They have to do the heavy lifting to explain what is really harming them with the Trump administration. Unless they do that, people will keep on voting for him because he lies continually, and they don't point out the lies, or they put them on page 2 or 3 or 4. They have to point it out, and they cannot give in if they have a debate of not fact-checking. That is so important because he lives on lies. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that, Stephen. The other element to bring to your comment, I think, is to talk about the fact that we live in a very different media world. So people can get their news from someone on YouTube who is parroting the lies that we hear from the administration, and they're not getting their news from a wide array of sources. And Ben, I think we're all still trying to figure out what that means and how to deal with it.
Yeah, I see it. It's a double-edged sword, right? I think you are absolutely right that especially for the sort of voters who are drawn to the political message that Trump and his allies are selling, frankly, I don't think a lot of them are reading the New York Times. That's a core part of what's happening, the sort of dissolution of the media environment. We're not listening to the same sources anymore. But the flip side, the thing for people listening is that we also live in a time of real abundance of strong independent sources, right? So Substacks like ours, ifyoucankeepit.org, it is free. I encourage everyone to subscribe. We send it about 3 times a week with all sorts of good things. But there are hundreds of other really excellent independent sources of information that people can be drawing from. And then the way I think about it, the way to respond is, you know, we have to get more comfortable getting more organic and more grassroots in how we disseminate information, right? So for everyone listening to this show, our role as citizens, we can't just be consumers of information anymore. We also have to be disseminators of trusted information, right? We have to be helping find out what is happening, what is true, and then spreading them in our networks, right? An underlying current of all of this is that most Americans we have a lot less trust in big institutions, especially news media, than we used to, than maybe would have been true 4, 5, 6 decades ago. But we still trust in our communities. We still trust in the people around us. So the response that I encourage people to do is to try to help step into that void, right? And, you know, we can't rely on big monolithic institutions to be spreading truth and fact anymore. We all have to get more involved in doing so.
And because of the Republican Party defunding public radio, NPR CEO Catherine Marr says she expects 80 stations across the country to go dark. In Indian country, they're expecting about 90% of tribal stations to go dark, which is devastating because, Professor Vilund, these are, in some cases, rural areas that rely on these stations for not only news, but emergency alerts. It's in some cases, it's the only station they have. So what are your thoughts about what Stephen laid out there and where people get their news?
So this is also a very complicated issue because for sure Donald Trump spouts a lot of lies and people can be influenced by that and that can mislead people and it's a real problem. And of course, you know, the free-for-all in the media system that Ben mentioned allows for a whole bunch of disinformation, conspiracy theories, and people can latch onto that. And, you know, the so-called echo chambers, they don't want to double check and cross check. So it's a real problem that arises from the new media environment, and it's a very serious issue. Now, the underlying problem is, of course, that modern politics is so phenomenally complex that it's very, very hard for anybody to have a clear sense of what's going on. You know, these issues are often not even, cannot even be resolved at the national level. Climate change, that is a supranational issue. And it's that phenomenal complexity that either people have to rely on experts and specialists and kind of delegate their judgment. And, you know, unfortunately, many people don't trust experts anymore. But that is the opportunity for populist leaders to come in and say, actually, this is pretty easy and straightforward, you know, believe me. And so it's not only sort of the fault of voters and citizens that they can't cope. Simply the objective situation is so very difficult, and I don't have a good sense of how to address that issue. Now, one point, however, I also want to make is among the opponents of Trump, there is often a sense of dismissing his voters as these dupes who fall for his lies and who are seduced by his charismatic authority. And while that there is a good amount of truth to that, it should not keep us analysts who try to understand what's going on from seeing the real issues and grievances and needs and interests that many people have. You know, so when lower income people vote for Donald Trump, it's easy to say, oh, they are duped and they are seduced by his charisma, but they might vote for Donald Trump not based on material issues, but on other issues that bother them. And I think we would be ill-advised in attributing too much importance to disinformation and lies and those things, and not kind of trying to understand with sort of analytical empathy, where do these people come from? What are the actual issues and problems that they see that for them are important? You know, so I think people like us don't understand why number of Trump voters have a problem with immigration, because for us, you know, we get a lot of benefits out of this. These are the nannies. These are the people who fix our roofs, whatever. We don't live in the areas where immigration can put pressure on housing prices. And so we don't understand. And we just think this is misinformation and lies. And I think it is important to be willing to entertain that supporters of these populist leaders like Trump, that they might have from their perspective, from their life circumstances, some real issues and real grievances. And so it's again a very complicated issue where we can't just kind of dismiss these people as being susceptible to lies and to disinformation.
Well, and to your point, Professor Vilund, when you listen to people who've taken polls and talked to voters, or if you listen to the voters, there's such a wide range, of course. Some people who voted for Biden say, you know, I voted for Democrats for years. I'm still struggling to make ends meet. My kid goes to a school with mold. I'm voting for Trump. It's just a wide range of reasons. Or Gilberto, who wrote in, we have to talk about the fact that part of the electorate is very attracted to the white nationalism of MAGA. So there's just a wide range there about why people voted for Trump. We've got a number of emails wanting you both to just talk about where we go from here. I want to first, since we're almost out of time, I want to play two clips and then ask you both to respond about what is happening in DC and where you think this could go, because a number of people are wondering how far is he willing to take all of this. So first off, Republican governors say that they are going to send National Guard troops to D.C. On Saturday, federal agents were filmed beating and detaining a food delivery driver in Northwest D.C. The officers did not respond to requests from witnesses to identify their agencies, though one flashed a badge that said ICE. Here is a clip from the Washington Post of people in the crowd asking for ID.
Hey, pull Chris off. Stop!
Get out of our city! Get out of our city!
Choke yourself out!
We're right here.
Yeah, yeah.
Turner.
What agency are you guys with?
Who are you guys?
Oh, are you guys the cops? Shut the
up. Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Take your mask off.
What agency are you guys with?
It's so easy to be behind a mask. Let's see, you guys tell us who you are. Who are you?
Well, you guys are ruining this country. You know that, right? Liberals already ruined it.
Oh, there we go.
Okay.
Okay. Can we see some badge work, guys?
Is that his property?
Hey, guys.
The liberals already ruined it. No number, no ID, no name.
So if you didn't hear that, someone in the crowd said to the agents, "You guys are ruining this country." And a guy wearing a police vest said, "Liberals already ruined it." We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, here is Trump threatening other cities.
So that are bad, very bad. You look at Chicago, how bad it is. You look at Los Angeles, how bad it is. We have other cities that are very bad. New York has a problem. And then you have, of course, Baltimore and Oakland. We don't even mention that anymore. They're so far gone. We're not going to let it happen. We're not going to lose our cities over this. And this will go further. We're starting very strongly with D.C., and we're going to clean it up real quick, very quickly, as they say. We're going to have a tremendous success in what we're doing. Other cities are hopefully watching this. They're all watching, just like everyone's watching here. They're all watching, and maybe they'll self-clean up.
So there are two clips there. A few people are writing in saying, how far do you think Trump will go in his desperation to maintain control? One listener says, would he manufacture a crisis or take us into a war to accomplish his ends? I mean, this is devastating to say, but people are armed in this country. What if someone gets shot at one of these actions? You know, could he implement martial law? Professor Vineland, how far do you think he will go?
So one of the very typical things of populist leaders like Donald Trump is that they talk really, really big. And fortunately, their actions are not nearly as bad as they talk. I mean, when you just think in the last 8 months, Donald Trump, right? So allegedly he wanted to take over Greenland and he wanted to take back the Panama Canal, you know? And I mean, all of this was essentially kind of big fireworks to draw attention and draw attention away from other things. And so the rhetoric of these populist leaders is much, much worse than what they actually end up doing. I mean, in the case of DC, this is under federal authority, so he has much more of a legal leg to stand on with his current takeover than he would have in other cities. And I kind of doubt that he would dare to do it in other cities. I mean, I think this is one of these typical populist kind of show theater things, right? I'm tough on crime and see these people marching up and down the street, you know, that this is not the way to fight any crime that exists and that crime in DC has gone down. Doesn't bother a populist leader like that. But my hunch is a lot of this is just bluster and show and, you know, scoring points with his base and demonstrating what a tough guy he is and all those things. And I don't think this is part of a plan of taking over one city after the other. That is my sense from having studied these loud-mouthed, big-talking populist leaders for a long time.
Ben, what are your thoughts?
I a little bit disagree, but only in the sense that I think he would like to. The question is, will he succeed? And thankfully, our system has some really strong protections against the use of the military for domestic law enforcement. But those protections are not going to be self-enforcing. So the question, the big thing I'm looking at is how do state and local leaders respond? The president has unique authority in Washington, D.C. He is the commander of the Washington, D.C. National Guard, but he's not the head of the National Guard in other states. And he does not have the same ability to intervene in local issues in your states and cities if you don't live in Washington, D.C. So the question is, Will mayors and governors in other states, will they push back aggressively, or will they tacitly accept that? And that's really what it comes down to. So if you are worried about this trend of the militarization of our streets, which you absolutely should be, the thing you need to be looking for is, are your local and state leaders prepared to aggressively push back and use every political and legal tool they have to resist this sort of incursion or not? I'm hopeful that we will. We've seen strong statements from all sorts of mayors and governors that are targeted, including here in California. But that's really what it comes down to. So if you're worried about this, call your mayor, call your governor.
We also got an email about the man who was tragically struck and killed by an SUV on Thursday after running from a federal immigration enforcement operation at a Home Depot in Monrovia. According to NBC Los Angeles, the immigration enforcement activity was reported to Monrovia police before 10 a.m. During the operation, someone ran from the scene, crossed Evergreen Avenue, entered a freeway, and then they were hit. I mean, this is just devastating. And the person later died at a hospital. And I'm really sorry, but I cannot find this person's name. So we know that this person who ran away from this raid was killed on a freeway. Thank you for bringing that up, because, again, it's just so hard to keep up with all of this. And that is why we are doing this weekly series. If you would like to let us know what you want us to cover or guests you'd like us to feature in the future, please email yourcall@kalw.org. And thanks to today's guests for joining us to kick off our first show. Ben Raderstorff is policy advocate at Protect Democracy. It's a nonpartisan anti-authoritarianism group. He writes the If You Can Keep It Substack newsletter. Kurt Vieland is professor in liberal arts at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of many books, including Democracy's Resilience to Populism's Threat, Countering Global Alarmism. Ben and Professor Vieland, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us, Rose. Great to see you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Thank
you. It was a pleasure discussing these issues with you.
So. Thank you so much. Thanks to Johanna Miyake for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.